From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In February of last year, NPR caught up with Mohamed Al-Baradei as news was breaking that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak had been forced to give up the presidency. Al-Baradei had returned to Cairo after he stepped down as head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and he had been an important counselor for anti-government protesters there. He told NPR's Robert Siegel that there was an electrified feeling in Egypt. "It's the greatest day of my life," he said. It was a moment of personal reflection for a man who spent a lifetime all over the world resolving conflicts. Dr. Al-Baradei is in Utah this week, and it's giving us an opportunity to talk about global security and his belief that countries need to experience a paradigm shift in how they approach peace in the world. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The best way to introduce today's show is just to introduce our guest. His experience implies the things he's seen and the broad range of subjects he can talk about. Dr. Mohamed Al-Baradei is the former general director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. During his tenure, he disputed U.S. claims that Iraq's Saddam Hussein was producing nuclear weapons. He's also been at the center of the questions over Iran's nuclear program. In 2005, he and the IAEA were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts. Dr. Al-Baradei is in Utah this week, here to speak about global security, and it's giving us an opportunity to talk to him about his ideas for finding an alternative to nuclear weapons. You can join the conversation if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST, our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Al-Baradei is speaking tomorrow at 3:30, giving the keynote address for the Tanner Humanity Center's World Leaders Lecture Forum. It's at Kingsbury Hall, and we'll give you the details about that later as well. Dr. Al-Baradei, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Doug, for having me.
Well, I suppose we should begin with the stories coming this morning from Libya and Egypt. U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, was killed along with three members of his staff in an attack on the U.S. consulate, the city of Benghazi. In Egypt, protesters scaled the walls of the U.S. embassy in Cairo, tore down the American flag there, angry over a film produced in the United States that's said to ridicule the Islamic prophet Muhammad. You're just seeing the news this morning. How are you reacting to all of this?
I feel terrible, Doug. I mean, that is, again, it's a deja vu all over again. You know, it just a lack of trust. It's the emotions just coming uncontrolled. There is no question that people are offended, their sensibilities is offended by a film that they think vilifying the prophet, you know. But that has no absolute justification to go and commit violence to kill people. This is a barbaric act. And as I just tweeted, you know, before coming here, Doug, it does no justice to themselves or to their religion, you know. But it's a small problem of a bigger problem, you know. How can we, you know, act rationally, build trust together, understand that how to contain extremism, understand that the only way we live together is through building bridges of dialogue. But using violence and counter-violence, it just takes us back to the Middle Ages, in my view.
It seems like this is such a theme that you have dealt with almost all of your career, this idea of trying to find a way beyond military arsenals into finding what you've talked about as these communities of trust.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen throughout my career, Doug, that, you know, use of force, you know, does not really resolve any conflict. It just adds to or exacerbates conflicts. It's simply by sitting as we are sitting today, putting our grievances on the table, talk about where we are coming from, understand each other, and find a way to reconcile our differences and take risk and compromise. It's the only way to move forward. It's very amazing to me how interconnected we have become, you know, as a global community, as one human family. There is not a single challenge I can think of, you know, from communicable diseases to arms control to, you know, financial crisis to climate change, that any one country alone can resolve it, you know, or can address it.
Because they're all interconnected.
They're all interconnected. I mean, they're all challenges without border, as I call them. And yet we never adjusted our management of at the social level to address the 21st century reality, you know, that we still think, you know, whoever has the biggest club is the one who's going to win, you know. And we have seen time after time that you cannot do that, that even with the most mighty arsenal you have, you are not solving any problem. You're at best delaying, you know, a conflict, or but then it comes to haunt you in even much more forceful way. Mm. You talk mostly about symptoms, but you never address the root causes, you know. I mean, you never ask why a person end up being a suicide bomber and not Mother Teresa, for example, yeah. You know. It's a question of environment. It's a question of education. It's a question of feeling that he's being treated justly, fairly. You know, and what you see in the Middle East today, you know, all that religious frenzy, it's really an act of anger. You know, people mm-hmm. feel they have been mistreated. They have been, you know, subject to double standard. They have been repressed by their own government and unfairly treated by the outside world. And this is, a lethal combination, yeah. You know, and that's what we see. All that is the symptoms, and you need to step back, take a holistic approach, and completely change the mindset, and not trying on using force or just, you know, exchanging insult or calling each other, you know, extremists.
But find another way. There's something you had said, or you're going to be talking about. I won't share any details about the speech we're going to be giving, but you make a reference to the motivational. A writer, Stephen Covey, who talks about that there needs to be a paradigm shift. That's what you've talked about here. And how do you think that plays out? What do you think that – how do you start by transforming the mindset, do you think?
By talking to each other. I mean, simple. I mean, look at the Iran situation, which I'm going to talk about, yeah. You know, tomorrow. I mean, for the last 6, 7, 8 years or 50 years, if you like, you know, the problem is getting worse because there are grievances from both sides between the U.S. and Iran. It started in 1953 when the CIA overthrew the first nationally elected government mm-hmm. in Iran. They supported the oppressive Shah of Iran. They supported the Iraq Saddam Hussein to attack Iran. And you expect then the Iranian will feel good about that. You know, there is a lot of anger. And then, of course, from the U.S. side, that the hostage crisis, right. You know, which created a lot of course, anger in the U.S. Well, this is not going to be, you know, resolved through covert operation, through allocating money for regime change in Iran. I mean, on the one hand, the U.S. is saying we are allocating funds for regime change, but on the other hand, saying, you know, trust us, you know, yeah. And don't try even to have any military capability. And we will not talk to you unless you change your behavior, which I find it extremely, you know, ironic because if
these preconditions.
It's absolutely. I mean, if you want to change behavior, Doug, you talk to the person. Yeah. You try. It's dialogue is a mean to change behavior and not a reward for good behavior. Yet that's what the U.S. attitudes throughout the years vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis North Korea, and even vis-a-vis Iraq. And in all this situation, I mean, you have to talk to your adversary. I don't need to talk to my friends. Yeah. I need to talk to my adversary. I understand why their frame of mind and how can I change that. Because at the end of the day, if we don't do that, we are going to self-destruct. When we have 19,000 nuclear warheads continue to exist in our world, we just cannot afford to make one single mistake.
You know, it's interesting that when President Obama proposed talking to Iran without any preconditions. Mm. He was criticized, of course, by conservatives, the other party. What do you make of that? I mean, that because that seems like the, I guess you felt like that was a good effort to say, all right, let's just talk.
I thought it was an excellent. And at that time, I was still a director general of the IAEA, and I was in direct contact with President Obama a number of times. And we were pretty close to cut a deal, actually, with Iran. Unfortunately, it fell apart because of Iranian domestic politics. And when Iran was ready, it fell apart because of the U.S. domestic policies. Because, again, President Obama was accused of being soft on defense, right. Of being talking to the crazy mullahs. You have to talk to the devil to get things straight.
I wanted to ask you about the speech that President Eisenhower gave in 1953. You've written about this. It was called Atoms for Peace.
Sure.
He said this. He said that if a danger exists in the world, it is a danger shared by all. And then 4 years later, the International Atomic Energy Agency was created. And you've written about that speech, that you were really taken by it. What was remarkable about what President Eisenhower said, do you think?
Well, he had the foresight of seeing what we have today. You know, every problem we have today is a problem of every one of us, you know, and every opportunity is an opportunity for every one of us. It's basically he foresaw, you know, that the interconnectivity that we have today in the world, and that we see it with more force. You know, what is happening in Somalia today, the famine in Somalia has an impact here. You know, what is happening in Afghanistan, you know, has an impact in Europe. I mean, we need to understand that, you know, we are our brother's keepers. I mean, the old question in the Bible, you know, this is really the, when we answer that, yes, I am my brother and sister keeper, I think that's when we are going to have peace in our world, you know. But as long as we continue to talk, it's us versus them, it's the Christians versus the Muslims, we continue to focus on what separates us, which is 5% at most, you know, and superficial. I've been all over the place, you know, throughout my career, and I'm amazed by how much we have in common. I mean, we're all the same human being, would like to have a decent life. We care about our children's education. We would like to have better, good health care. I mean, who cares, you know, what your religious or belief is? Who cares what language you speak, what color you are? These are super, what even passport you carry. I mean, and basically, I think what we have to be, you know, peace is about individual, about human beings, you know. I think if every human being, and I still do believe that in my heart, Doug, if every one of us have the environment when he can live in peace, freedom, and dignity, only then we are going to have peace in our world.
You have written about, you were a young lawyer and a professor of international law when you heard about the Atoms for Peace ideal. You thought a lot about this when you were younger. And I'm wondering, did your career take the path that you intended? I mean, had you always been interested in international relations, or are you surprised that you've ended up here?
Well, in a way, I am surprised. I never planned it that way. Huh. I mean, I as a young lawyer who graduated in Cairo, and then I was always curious to see what is, you know, across the border, if you like. And yeah. I came to the U.S. as a young student. I went to NYU Law School. And as you know, New York is a microcosm of the world. And it was amazing and interesting and challenging to be able to talk to every person from every part of life. And again, that's where I discovered, you know, that we are all the same, you know, that we really need to work together. And that our diversity is our strength. And then I got involved into, you know, arms control and nuclear energy, and I ended up where I have been today. But it was never planned. And you do your work and leave the rest to...
Yeah, right. Fate or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But what is it that you... I wonder, did you, in your family or in relationships that you had, like in school or those places, were you always the peacemaker?
Yeah, I always sort of trying to see what can help us to move forward, frankly. Huh. And I always felt that I would have to look at the big picture, you know, and
That was the key, the big picture.
The big picture. Yeah. I mean, you see all this... little people, if I call it, you know, running over, focusing on minutia. You know, if you look at the big picture, you see a completely different perception or perspective. I'm very happy. I mean, I have a son and a daughter. I mean, my daughter is married to a Brit. You know, she lives in London. My son has an American girlfriend. He works in Istanbul. You know, and for them, you know, color, you know, nationality, ethnicity, they're totally blind to that. And and I think, you know, I'm very proud that they ended up that way. And I'd like to see the world in that image, frankly. Because that's the only way for our salvation, I believe.
I wonder, you've written about the fact that when you visited the Middle East in your capacity with the IAEA, you had these impressions that you've written about of that kind of love-hate relationship with the people there and with the U.S. and in particular, but the West, I guess, in general. What do you think you understand about? I guess we were talking about this earlier. I guess it comes down to it's complicated, that there's a lack of trust, that there are deep roots. Do you think it gained any insights into that really dicey relationship now?
It's a very love-hate relationship, and it's a very curious relationship. Mm. All these guys who are now demonstrating today in front of the U.S. embassy would like to send their kids to be educated in the U.S. You see, it's even in Iran, you know, when I've been quite often, I mean, with the government is quite hostile to the U.S., and the people are very hostile to the U.S. foreign policy. But there is a difference between a U.S. foreign policy and U.S.
They make a distinction.
The rule of law, freedom, you know.
Popular dignity, culture.
Popular culture, jazz, you know. every, you know, this is for them. McDonald's, you know. It's quite different. And I think that distinction, and they have this schizophrenic, if you like. You know, I hate the U.S. foreign policy, but I'd love the U.S. and I'd love the Americans. You know, that is, and how we can get the two together, frankly. But there is a lot of frustration that the U.S. has not been an honest broker in the Middle East, you know. And, of course, many of them, they wake up in the morning, what do they see? Middle Eastern or Muslim being killed in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or, you know, in Libya, and whatever. And if then an extremist come and tell them, well, there is a conspiracy against you, for an average person, it's easy to believe. Yeah. You know, it is. He doesn't understand, or she doesn't understand, that this is really down to earth, dirty politics. It has nothing to do with conspiracy against religion or against culture. It's just competition of ideologies, and there is a lot of education, I believe. You know, and I just met at the hotel today, you know, nine young Egyptians, you know, coming from a religious university, and I was very happy to see them here, and they said, well, it's a different world for us. It's a different world we see here, you know, completely different from the stereotype we hear back in Egypt. And I told them the only solution, you know, for the Middle East is for everybody to travel, you know, back and forth. And you travel once. I've seen that with young people. You travel once outside, and your perception of the world, your perception of reality, your perception of what the other people look and act like is completely different. And I'm very optimistic in that sense, because you know, I see the young people who triggered the revolt in Egypt. You know, they have basically quite a different or away from ideology. I mean, because they see on the net, you know, how other people live. They dialogue with people on the net. They have been focused on really what matters. You know, shared humanity, science, education, career development, and so if you look at the young generation, I think I still have a lot of hope.
Yeah. One of the things you've been encouraging the United States to do, and the West in general, is rely more on soft power. This is something you've been thinking a lot about lately, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what, as you know, the term coined is, the U.S. has a lot of attraction. You know, the U.S., as a young lawyer that came here in the 60s, it was amazing to see the freedom you enjoy, the liberty you can exercise, the rule of law, the due process, you know, social mobility. And these are the soft powers that you have at the pop culture. These are the soft power you have to export to the rest of the world. You are not the American who is coming to revenge for 9/11. You know, it was terrible. You know, but you have to look at 9/11 as a symptom of a much bigger problem, and say dialogue with the people, tell them what a real U.S., real American is really about. You know, and you have a lot to be proud of. You know, and you have a lot to export in terms of soft power. And again, that's the way, people to people, and not forget governments. I mean, in my view, you know, peace is too important to be left to government. If you like, I mean, I think the role of civil society, you know, the role of people to people, you know, saying, well, we have enough of that. You know, we need to live together. We don't need to destroy each other. We have a lot of shared humanity. It's fantastic, you know, to be in D.C. and go to a Ethiopian restaurant. You know, it's fantastic to be here, to, and, you know, in Egypt and here, you know, Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, this is what we have to focus on, and not the silly stuff about, you know, where should we, you know, establish the borders, you know, who is going to do what, you know. These are becoming more and more marginal, and nobody cares about it, frankly. If I come from Europe, I've lived in Europe for many years, does anybody care or even notice when you cross borders in Europe? You don't, you know. It's, you know, or what, whether you have an Irish passport or a French passport, nobody cares about that. I mean, we care about how we are going to overcome the financial crisis, how we are going to deal with the tuition for our kids, how we are going to have a better health care, you know, how we are going to invest more in scientific research. I mean, that is what we really should focus on and tell governments, you know, listen, you know, we would like to live together. You know, look at the big picture. We are becoming more and more united. Let us focus on that, and we will judge you on your performance from that perspective, and not that you spend. Well, we spend $1.5 trillion on armaments a year, you know, and we spend less than 1% on peacekeeping operation around the world. I mean, this just gives you, you know, some figures, Doug. We have 3 billion people, half the world population, live under $2.5 a day. $2.5 a day. And we expect that people to be happy, that people to be, you know, that, as I always keep saying, poverty is a weapon of mass destruction because it leads to lack of good governance, to repression, to anger, to marginalization, to civil wars. So you really need to start where you ought to start, you know, give people an equal opportunity, to be empowered in how they are going to be governed, a sense of dignity. What you see in the Middle East right now is that lack of sense of dignity on the hand of their dictators and supported by the Western powers and primarily the U.S. And that's why you see that anger. It's this emotional, you know, outlet, you know, which is... And that has to be controlled because we can't afford it. I mean, we live in a world right now, as I said, we still have technology spread all over, particularly weapon of mass destruction technology. And I do not want to wait and see one of these extremist groups getting hold of radioactive, powerful radioactive source or a nuclear material. Well, that's the beginning of the end, because the so-called concept of deterrence, you know, that I will not use nuclear weapon even if I have it because I'll be pulverized. Well, it doesn't, as Henry Kissinger mentioned often, and George Shultz and Bill Perry and many other, you know, veterans of the Cold War, deterrence has become irrelevant to an extremist group who is ready to sacrifice their life in the process. So, and they that's why they have become apostle of disarmament. You know, that they have said this: any nuclear weapons is decreasingly effective, increasingly hazardous. That is their words. You know, and to see Kissinger and Shultz in his 90s going around the world preaching nuclear disarmament, tell me that we are going the right direction. To see that President Obama saying that he would like to see a world free from nuclear weapon. I mean, it was, you know, heart-wrenching, you know, to see, you know, the president of the U.S. talking about a world that does not depend on nuclear weapons. Mm.
Dr. Mohamed Al-Baradei is with us. He's a Nobel Prize laureate, the former head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tomorrow at 3:30, he's going to be giving the keynote address for the Tanner Humanities Center's World Leaders Lecture Forum. It's at Kingsbury Hall. The event, we should say, is free. It's open to the public, but tickets are required. To learn more, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're joined in studio by Mohamed Al-Baradei. He's the former general director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, a Nobel Prize laureate. He's in Utah this week to talk about global security and the need to find an alternative to nuclear weapons and a paradigm shift in how we approach peace in the world. And we'll tell you more about the lecture that he's going to be giving tomorrow at the Kingsbury Hall in Salt Lake City. It's tomorrow at 3:30. I wanted to come back to this question of Iran and the controversy surrounding the nuclear program. First, I was interested in how you're seeing the issue covered in the Western media. What do you make of that?
Well, a lot of hype, Doug, frankly. I mean, to put it, you know, succinctly, there is a problem. There's a major problem of insecurity in the Middle East. There is a fundamental issue of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which has been going or festering since 1945, you know, while we continue to wring our hands. We all know what is the blueprint of a solution, that you have to have two states, you know, a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, and both should have security, recognized borders, etc. But we have not, we have been giving in to extremism and to those who are saying, you know, I need perfect security. But perfect security for me is perfect insecurity for my fellow citizens, other, you know, neighbors. And we need to understand that we have to make compromises, take risk, and understand that no durable peace will ever be last until people perceive it to be fair and just. Right. You know, even at the individual level, unless you feel that you have been justly treated or fairly treated, you will balk. You know, and again, Iran is part of this complex web of insecurity. Iran has been told, you know, or labeled part of axis of evil. And put yourself in the seat of the Iranian. If you are being told you are axis of evil and we are allocating resources to change your regime, and forget about whether they are theology, you know, whether they are democracy, autocracy. Every regime cares for its survival. And every people care for the dignity of their country. I mean, the 1 million Iranians who live in Los Angeles are very indignant of the way Iran is being treated. They hate the regime there. But they still, there's a difference between loving your country and hating a government, you know, and we need to understand that. And you are not, I mean, the way Iran is portrayed in the media here, that they are a bunch of mad mullahs, they are going to get a bomb fairly quickly to attack the U.S. and Israel. Well, things are quite different and quite complex than that. I mean, there's a lot of questions about their you know, program. They need to be, you know, they have committed deception. They need to be clear about their intention. I mean, all that is there. But if you talk to them, I mean, they are fairly, you know, rational people. They know that, you know, even if they even think of using nuclear weapon, they'll be pulverized. They continue to say, and I do believe, they want to have the capability to have a nuclear weapon because they believe if they have that capability, they would be recognized as a major power in the Middle East. And that is really their goal, to be recognized by the U.S. as a major power in the Middle East. They do not want to see the fate of Saddam Hussein. I mean, they know that Saddam Hussein did not have nuclear weapon and Iraq was being smashed. But they would like to see themselves to be in the seat of North Korea, that because North Korea had nuclear weapon or have nuclear weapon,
They've been taken seriously
and told politely, let us sit around the table and negotiate,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There is, you know, this is the real politique, if you like. You know, this is the real...
But you said the word rational, which is interesting. It became such a political fight. Just the word was applied to Iran, as you know, a couple of months ago, and it became such an issue in the media, and it became an issue just in the political fight that's going on between, so, you know, Democrats and Republicans. Yeah. And I'm wondering if that dynamic, does it worry you that a country like the United States that's so divided internally is going to be able to play the proper role to mediate some of these disputes internationally?
It does worry me because, Doug, any action or inaction at the international level has an impact on everybody, whether you are a Republican or a Democrat. I've seen the same division in Iran between the liberals and or the so-called liberals and the conservative. And again, international policies should not be hostage to domestic policies, should not be used as a tool to get more votes, you know, because you can be elected, but you can end up destroying your country in the process, you know, and there are certain, you know, certain issues that has to, you know, rise above the fray of domestic politics. And international peace and security is one of that. You know, we live in a world when, as I said, we have 9 countries with nuclear weapons. We have a lot of sophisticated extremist groups. We just can't afford to continue to go back to our trenches, you know, and continue to, you know, shoot from the trench against my so-called enemy, because we'll end up both of us losing at the end, you know. And Obama said, you know, that I would like to talk, you know, to Iran on the basis of mutual respect. And that was a change of paradigm. That was a change of mindset, frankly. It's unfortunate it didn't work that way. But what went behind the scene give me hope that soon enough, hopefully, it would happen once once election takes place, both in the U.S. and Iran. You know, we go back to serious business, I hope, you know.
Well, as you know, Israel is determined to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And leaders say a military attack is, the only realistic approach to dealing with this. Now, you're very opposed to this. You think it could be a disaster.
I think it would simply turn the Middle East into a ball of fire. I've been saying that for 4, 5, 6 years. And I do every day have much stronger conviction about that. I mean, imagine that in the impact on the oil, on the Strait of Hormuz, you know, the oil prices will soar. It will be a disruption of supply, and much worse. I mean, if that were to happen, the first thing Iran will do, it will go on a crash course to develop nuclear weapon, even if they are not going to do that today. And nobody until today, and I should say that, said that Iran is actually developing nuclear weapon. I mean, the 16 intelligence agency in the U.S. continue to be of the view that Iran have done some experimental studies, and they stopped that in 2003. And they never suggested until today that Iran is manufacturing nuclear weapons. So when I say things are being hyped, you know, I am even relying on information provided by the American intelligence. So we need to take things in perspective. Yes, there is a concern. Yes, Iran need to clarify its intentions. But when the Israel say that, you know, we need to bomb Iran, you know, how are you going to bomb knowledge? You know, I mean, the technology is there, the knowledge is there. You can simply delay the program, but they will come back with a vengeance. And in the process, the Middle East will turn into a ball of fire. So this is a zero option, frankly. And everybody think it's a zero option. I've talked to some major figures in the Bush administration before, and they, you know, for aside from the rhetoric, I mean, on one-to-one, they'll tell you that the diplomatic solution is the only option. I mean, I talked to them once, you know, and I wouldn't mention, you know, but somebody fairly high in the administration. And I said diplomatic solution is the best option. And his answer was, it's not the best option. It's the only option. That was President Bush.
I wanted to ask you about talk about Egypt and the revolution there. You were critical in counseling and talking to the protesters there, of course. You withdrew from the race for the presidency of Egypt in January. I mean, you worried about the military-led transitional government and whether the conditions for democracy were in place. I'm wondering, do you regret that at all?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm a lawyer, Doug, and I'd like to see things done, you know, with a tinge of legitimacy, you know. And I could not have run for being a president where I don't know my job description. There is no constitution that define your job description. Unfortunately, until today, 18 months or 19 months after the uprising, we still don't have a constitution. We still don't have a parliament. We have a president who have both the legislative and executive power in his own hand. So it's a pretty messy management of transition. Constitutional transition has been quite messy. The army, I should say, have a lot to be, you know, blamed for. I mean, they had no clue how to run the country. They are good maybe into, you know, drawing up a military plan, but they had no clue about how to politically transit a country after decades of authoritarian system, decades of dictatorship into a full-fledged democracy. Surely it takes time, but you have to start with putting in place a constitution that, you know, a consensus constitution that have general agreement, right, left, and center, that embodies the basic values of where every Egyptian can agree to. I mean, here in the U.S., I mean, you have the extreme left, extreme right, but nobody questioned due process, rule of law, Supreme Court. I mean, there are certain basic values that are the cornerstone of what you call a nation, you know. And
was this a flaw, do you think, then for the younger protesters? Because you've been quoted as saying that they didn't embrace institutional leadership. They didn't really embrace these structures. Was that a problem, do you think?
It was a problem, yeah. And I think they're realizing that today. I mean, as they always say, that revolution eats its own children. And in fact, unfortunately, you know, the young people, the people who really, the Facebook people, the people who triggered the resolution, revolution, lost. I mean, they found themselves that they have been marginalized.
Cut out.
And that's why now we have a new party called Constitution Party, which I'm trying to put the young...
Founded, we should say.
Yeah, and put the youth together. And now I'm telling them, now is the time to move from being a revolutionary into a politician, you know, and I think we are getting a lot of support. I mean, they started to understand, you know, that you can, if you really want to achieve the goals of the revolution, which is basically freedom and social justice, you have to work through the system and an institution and a parliament and constitution. And they are learning in the process. It is, you know, moving from a total dictatorship into a full democracy. It's not a linear line. Yeah. It will take time. And of course, I've been frustrated. I've been a bit depressed that it didn't work the way it should. But if you take a historical perspective, well, all right, maybe it takes a little bit time more. But all I want to do is to make sure that we are on the right track, that we have a constitution and in a structure that guarantees basic freedoms, basic rights for every Egyptian, and so a minimum decent standard of basic needs, social justice. I mean, what you have seen today in the streets of Cairo, I mean, again, that cuts across a lot into the question of freedom of expression, freedom of religion, how to balance, you know, freedom and organize religion and guarantee basic freedom. I mean, that's one of the major issues we are facing today in Egypt, you know. The balance between how much religion can be part of the structure and how at the same time guarantee the basic rights and freedom of individual, freedom of expression particularly, and freedom of religion. I mean, I've yesterday said that the only way we can move forward as human family is for respect for everybody's belief, everybody's sacred, things, every prophet, but we don't have to make judgment on each other. I mean, you are free to believe in whatever you want to believe on, as long as you don't get into my own court. And that's the only way we can coexist. But don't make judgment. You know, just be more inclusive and not exclusive. I think that's, again, an issue we need to do, how we can be more inclusive in our approach.
You know, it's interesting. You've lived all over the world. When you went back to Cairo, you were greeted as this hero. It was really tumultuous when you returned. Now they've been through this process, and I'm wondering, you've lived in the United States, you've lived in Europe, you've lived all over. Do you still think of Cairo as the place you want to end up? I mean, is that ultimately home?
Well, that's where I grew up, Doug. But frankly, home for me is the world right now. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I feel comfortable everywhere in the world right now. I mean, I feel comfortable, you know, anywhere when I am. I feel free. I will feel secure. I feel I have my basic needs. I feel I have the right to, you know, to express my views. I mean, I've lived in the U.S. for 15 years. I lived in Europe for 25 years. I lived in Cairo, I think, maybe another, or Egypt, 25 years. So, yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, but where I put my effort right now is my home country, because I see that they have been lagging behind. Right. You know, I don't think Europe needs me or the U.S. needs me. I mean, I'd love to be here all the time. But where I'm needed most is in the developing world, you know, in a place like Egypt, when I would like to make sure that they will catch up with the rest of the world. And that's why I do go quite often right now to developing countries. Next month I go to Brazil to give a couple of talks. I mean, again, on the same theme, you know, wake up and smell the coffee.
Mentioning Brazil, though, raises a question that I wanted to ask you about, because you've written about what was – Brazil and Argentina used to be in this sort of nuclear arms race. Sure. And you've talked about those two countries as a model for a way forward, developing really sort of a communal, I suppose, or community. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, Brazil and Argentina for a couple of decades were racing to develop nuclear weapons, you know – with a lot of rivalry between the two. And then they've realized, and that also was during time when both of them were under dictatorship. Yeah. And then they've realized, turning into democracy, that this is a silly race, you know, that they better put their act together, they better cooperate together and build a cooperative arrangement. So they put all the nuclear facilities under each other's supervision, in addition to the International Atomic Energy Agency supervision, and they're moving forward. I mean, they realize this is wasted resources. We'd like to spend that money on development, on poverty, on healthcare, on education. And you see at Brazil and Argentina right now, I've been, you know, obviously in Brazil, and, you know, it's become a major emerging economy. And it could be a model for the Middle East, you know. Get the Israelis, get the Palestinians, get the Arabs, talk together, agree on a security arrangement, and agree to be able to live together and just move or transit from this environment of hatred into environment of shared humanity.
Let me ask you this finally. You were sort of talking about this anyway, but you've talked about wanting to be this agent for change, and you have been for so many years. Is that your role, do you think, for the near future? And are you thinking at all about politics anymore?
Well, I'm politics in the large sense. I don't want to have any formal position.
You don't want to be president of Egypt?
No, I think I'm much more effective right now, given stage of my life, to be outside of running for an office, but basically working as a godfather, if you like, you know, and I can say that giving my age, you know, and it just basically tell people, you know, this is my experience. I want to impart my experience to you. I would like to make sure that you have a better life, that your children and grandchildren will have a better life. And that, you know, I'm working with young people. I mean, I'm putting all my focus with the youth, you know, and trying to guide them in the right direction. And I think it gives me a lot of satisfaction. I get a lot of vilification in the process, too. You know, once I speak about freedom or dignity or democracy, I got it during Mubarak time. I got it after, you know, from some of the political Islam people. I mean, I get it all the time. But as Ronald Reagan said, you know, it's like Teflon. It doesn't stick. You know?
Dr. Mohamed Al-Baradei, he's a Nobel Prize laureate and the former head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tomorrow at 3:30, he's going to be giving the keynote address for the Tanner Humanity Center's World Leaders Lecture Forum. It's at Kingsbury Hall. The event is free. It's open to the public, but tickets are required. To learn more about that, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Dr. Al-Baradei, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Doc, to be with you today.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Bob Goldberg and the staff of the Tanner Humanity Center. Thanks also to Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.